The ARA acknowledges the traditional owners of the land where we have recorded this podcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present, and recognise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders as Australia's first traders, who utilise a sophisticated network of trading paths that have facilitated the exchange of goods, knowledge, and culture for millennia.
Hi, I'm Paul Zara, CEO of the Australian Retailers Association, and welcome to Season 6 of the Retail Therapy Podcast, proudly brought to you by American Express. In today's retail landscape, it's vital to understand the nuance and intricacies of diversity, equality, and inclusion. It isn't just a buzzword, but a powerful force driving innovation and change across the sector. In each episode this season, we'll be focusing on the specific branch of the D&I tree, speaking to pioneers and leaders in their respective fields. Joining me for some retail therapy is Angel Dixon, a passionate activist for disability inclusion and human rights. Angel is a two-time international Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week model, and in 2017, Angel became the first agency sign model with a physical impairment to feature in a national television campaign. Since then, she has used her profile to create positive changes towards community attitude, serving as CEO and board member of the Attitude Foundation. She was named 2019 Queensland Young Australian of the Year and has received a Medal of the Order of Australia for her work, and I can't wait to hear her story and insights today. Angel, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to have a chat.
Now, Angel, let's start off with your story. Would you be comfortable talking about your disability and how that influenced you growing up and in your early career?
Yeah, sure. Look, I grew up as a person without disability. I acquired my impairment when I was 19. So the impact of a journey through the experience of, I guess, instant and dramatic life change when you acquire an impairment later in life is somewhat traumatic, as is symptom navigation and the management of disability itself. I came from a family who had a very medical perception of disability, which obviously had an impact on the way I saw myself after I acquired my impairment. For those that are listening to this who are new to disability, there are a lot of different perceptions of disability around. The most pervasive perception or understanding is called the medical model of disability, and that kind of raises the idea that people with disability are objects of a medical environment that we need to be fixed in some way, or that disability or impairment is the individual's puzzle to solve, when I guess a more contemporary understanding is a more social and human rights model of disability, which is that disability is everyone's problem. We all solve this puzzle together, and impairment is part of the disability ecosystem, but disability is understood from a social perspective, is that it is the barriers that we encounter that cause us to be disabled. That understanding took me a long time to to acquire myself. So when I'm speaking to people and trying to impart the wisdom that I have acquired on my journey, I have a lot of empathy for people who don't know what they don't know, and I certainly didn't know what I didn't know for a long time when I first acquired my impairment, which unfortunately caused a lot of hardship along the way. I saw myself as quite a burden, trying to navigate through employment after acquiring an impairment was something that was quite challenging, particularly with that pervasive understanding in our society. So I went through a disability employment agency who ironically didn't know how to support people with disability because of that pervasive perception. They really they knew what subsidies were available for employers, and they knew what employers felt more comfortable with when looking at a resume of a person with disability. So I guess that was helpful. And funnily enough, I was successful in one of those positions, but I was only given a job for 6 months, and it was made known to me that I was only given a job for 6 months with no security for the future, because that was as long as the subsidy would last. So very, very quickly after I acquired my impairment, I was confronted with a lot of these social barriers that I guess put me in good stead for my future of advocacy. Long story short, I ended up moving to San Francisco, where I lived for about 3 years, and I spent a lot of time in Berkeley with, which is the heart of the disability rights movement, with some incredible activists and people with diverse impairments and experiences. And I learned everything I could possibly learn about the history of the disability rights movement and the future. And then I came back to Australia and just wanted to push the needle.
Can I ask, Angel, are you working currently?
I'm a mum currently. I am working. I'm working.
That's a full-time job to me.
I have a 3-year-old, and 3 years ago I stepped away from my role as CEO at Attitude Foundation. But I held on to a very casual role at Griffith University here doing research in the social studies area around disability. So I do dip in and out of that when I can. But at the moment, until next year, I'm mumming it.
fair enough. And that's always, a challenge with children. Now I wanted to ask you about that. Given your impairment, how has that posed challenges for you on a personal level with a child, but also, breaking into modelling? What were some of the biggest challenges you faced there professionally?
Yeah, it's interesting. I had modelled very briefly in my teenage years. My mum was a bit of a stage mum, and she liked the idea of me, being on screen in some way. So I had tried it, and after my impairment, I thought this might be a good way, for some representation. And the very first agency I applied for wrote back with a very nice email saying, look, you're very beautiful, but there would be nothing in the industry that we could foresee you being suitable for. So I don't think we could accept you.
Goodness.
And unfortunately, that's a really common story that I've heard. That was probably about 10 years ago now, and things have changed slightly. But that really crushed me at the time. It wasn't something that I am hugely passionate about. My lifelong goal was not to become a model, but it was to use it as a platform in some way, and it still hurt, particularly when something is so personal to your physical being. And I guess when I was successful in, I guess, as you said, breaking into the industry, there were challenges that came along with that. But I made sure that I was only working with brands and agencies and people that understood the barriers, understood what was needed for the industry to move forward, and understood why I was there. And that took a lot of education. I am often the first person with disability that a brand has worked with, and so sometimes that's a good thing because we can work together and we can navigate it and tailor it to what works for them as well as what works for me. I always try to leave the door open for the people coming up after me. And I've obviously tried to carve a path for people with disability in the industry as well. But it's still a challenge. I still, even though I've had a break, I still do little bits here and there, and I'm seen as a special addition to any shoot that I'm on or any runway I'm on. I'll often have a story that I tell about a makeup artist at Melbourne Fashion Week who came up to me, patted me on the back during the pre-show stuff and told me how special it was that I was there and how excited I must be to be on a runway. I just sort of said, oh, well, you know, it's not as fancy as LA Fashion Week, but yeah, you know, it is pretty exciting. thanks for that.
I mean, well-intentioned, but wrong message.
Yeah.
Definitely. What about the challenges, Angela, as a mum?
Yeah, being a mum has been, for anyone, it's a huge growth opportunity, let's call it that. I needed to be prepared for the act of becoming a mum as far as falling pregnant, because my impairment meant that I needed to be prepared for any possible thing that could happen. So it was quite nice. I could tailor things to me. I could prepare as much as possible for medical things, but also making sure that I knew how to change a nappy with one hand, you know, all of the practicalities. What I hadn't really prepared for was what would happen when he got to toddler stage and I needed to be running around after him, wearing him out. The questions that come around why mummy's body works differently. I thought I had all of that worked out, but I had spoken to people before about their children and how the questions never really came because they just grew up with it and it was there every day. But my son is quite inquisitive and he likes to know how things work, and so there are extensive conversations that we have to have about why mummy can't pick you up sometimes. And it's hard. It's isolating a lot of the time because I don't know many people with disability who are parents as well, certainly not to the extent that I have with my impairment, certainly not to the same extent. And it's hard, but we navigate it. And I know that the work that I'm doing now with my son to prepare him for the future can only shape his perspective for the world around him moving forward.
Definitely. Now, you've also been a vocal advocate for body positivity and self-love whilst also promoting diversity and inclusion. Can you discuss some of the challenges you've encountered and the progress you've seen in these areas, both in the fashion industry and society as a whole?
Well, I think certainly I don't know that I've ever been called a body positivity pro person, but I guess I am. I think everyone could say that there's definitely been, in media and marketing especially, a huge push towards self-love and diversity and inclusion in the past 10 years. I think social media has played a huge role in the voices that are out there in this space. At Attitude Foundation, we work very hard to make sure that the perceptions of disability aren't as narrow as what they perhaps used to be, not as polarized from super, super negative to super, super positive. We want to make sure that there's a balanced view of how people with disability are seen, first as people and second as, you know, participating members of society, with the full range and dynamics of life and emotions that everyone has. And I really do think that that's moved forward. I saw recently, Paul, that you met Dylan Alcott, who is a huge proponent for all of the things that I am, and he's done a great job over the last few years moving the needle in Australia as well.
He certainly has. I mean, I think he's challenged us all. I mean, I was actually in awe of meeting him, but truly inspirational.
He is. He's a good bloke. He does what he can where he can. He likes to, you know, make things happen.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see that these conversations are at the level that they're at now. I think the thing that perhaps is missing from a lot of the conversations now, or not missing, but now that we've progressed slightly, we could probably push it a little bit further and start talking about I guess equity isn't really understood as well as it should be. So when we're talking about body positivity, and if I think about my own experience as a parent, the frustrations that I have are that there are so many people that will say, gee, I don't know how you do it. You're doing such a great job. I wouldn't be able to do it if I was disabled. And those kinds of comments are in some way really helpful, but also really isolating.
Yes.
And it can instill fear in even the people that are around me every day. So they're almost fearful to say, do you need help? Or, you know, what is your daily experience? Because I guess they're not sure what's okay, what's okay to say. There isn't too much practical information out and about at the moment. A lot of it is promotion. A lot of it is seamlessly integrating people with disability into everyday life. But how to navigate those very everyday conversations and topics sort of isn't out there as much as I'd like it to be. So when we're talking about body positivity and those kinds of things, my experience of, you know, having paralysis down one side of my body, yes, it's an extreme version of perhaps what someone else might be experiencing as far as, you know, maybe they've got a sore back or they had an impermanent impairment one day and, you know, that was frustrating for them. Those things are different, but the experience of the emotions going through it are fairly the same. And to come to a conversation from that kind of equity perspective of that our experiences are different, we've started from a different place, but we're both people and we can hold space for each other and have empathy and compassion, even though our experiences are very different, I think will hold a lot of value and will be huge for our community moving forward.
Given your lived experience, Angel, what advice would you give to individuals who may be facing similar challenges, either in their career or day-to-day life, due to having a disability?
It's interesting. The phrasing of the question is something that I would like to attack.
Go for it.
First.
It felt wrong me saying it, to be honest. We should have that conversation.
Yeah, we need to start dissecting these things and making sure that, you know, we're being clear on the language, because when we're talking about disability, it is the way I explained it at the beginning, it's an ecosystem and there are so many things that fit under that header. So when I'm talking to people about acquiring an impairment, things that I would talk about pertaining to impairment are very different to the way I would speak about disability itself or disability as a whole. So if I'm talking to someone who's entering an employment setting, I would only be speaking social model. I would be saying, you know, you've got rights, need to ensure that all those barriers are brought down for you so that you can have equal access and shared and common experiences to your co-workers and all of those kinds of things. But if I'm talking to someone about impairment, I'm going, your impairment is individual to you. It is a unique experience. No one has a shared physical common experience like yours. Don't be hard on yourself. Don't compare yourself. Think about, you know, the common things that you can find with the people around you, disabled or not, and create a community that is supportive of you as a person, and try really hard not to isolate yourself based on identities, and all those kinds of things.
Yes.
There's a lot to say.
No, well, look, thank you for reframing that, because I think that's really, really helpful for people listening to understand. And it's often, you know, people that don't have those challenges that can have got the most to learn. And I see that, and I hear that, and I feel that. So I think it's important that, you know, part of this series is to educate employees and employers within the retail industry specifically, but hopefully we'll even cast a wider net. So thank you for that conversation. It was important to have. Now, I'm going to move on. As a society, we've made progress in embracing inclusivity, but we still have so far to go. And what do you see as the main areas needing improvement?
Also a very, very broad, large question. The reason that I work with Griffith University at the moment is because I believe that our healthcare industry has a huge role to play in the way that disability exists in our current society. When a baby is welcomed into the world and is a person with Down syndrome or a person with any kind of impairment or disability, and the doctor says, "I'm sorry," that changes the trajectory for that baby for the rest of their lives. When a family isn't consulted or supported appropriately because of medical perspectives of disability, when a loved one has acquired an impairment or is going through some kind of thing pertaining to an impairment, that can cause huge repercussions, not just in their health, but it can affect the way that they're welcomed into education, into their career, the way that they're supported by their friends and loved ones in every area of their life. And so I'm so passionate about working within the health industry at the moment, because we really need to do something about that. The way those things come down the line have had a significant effect on our education system, the barriers that are present for people with disability in education, simply because of a lack of accessibility, not necessarily inclusivity, because there are a lot of well-meaning educators, a lot of well-meaning institutions out there who are trying to do their best, but accessibility itself is such a broad topic that needs to be discussed further, and it really needs to be better understood. The barriers are just incredible. And so when you think about people coming into the world, people accessing basic things like education, and then we find them, you know, in either they're not in a job or they are in a job. When they are in a job, a lot of people with disability either hate their job or feel stuck to their job because they were lucky enough to get there. These are the real practical things that we're having problems with. We can talk about inclusivity until we're blue in the face, but the practicalities of these everyday things really need to be addressed before we can talk about anything else. So yeah, look, I could keep going.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to dig deeper, ask some more questions.
Yeah, no, well, I'm going to just explore a little bit further. I think you've covered some of this, but I'm just keen to hear from you. It's not a question I've really explored with many others, if any, really around those common misconceptions around people living with a disability. And how do you think it's best to educate people and allow them to address them? And specifically, if there's any comments around the retail industry, because we're the largest private employer. There's 1.4 million people work in the industry. It's the largest, you know, it's a big sector. It's $420 billion. So we've got a lot to play from a leadership point of view. But the question here for you is you've explored all some of these already, Angel, but any other common misconceptions you'd like to address?
So I could probably share some stories from over the years to give some specific or maybe some practical things to take away. I've worked with some people, and if we're talking about the retail space specifically, when the biggest thing is that people with disability are consumers. Not only are we workers, but we're consumers. And unfortunately, when people with disability are shopping, as we do, because that's what we like to do, there are considerable barriers. I often encounter doorways that are blocked by, you know, large tables of merchandise. I often end up at a counter where I'm trying to pay and there is a pay station fixed to the desk that I can't access independently, and I have to ask someone to hold my credit card and pay for me, which causes a whole lot of legal issues, not just frustration. So they're my personal stories, but I have also worked and spoken with many people who perhaps are deaf or use sign language to communicate. And there are a lot of perceptions of people in retail who don't understand that and have often got into altercations with people with disability who they thought that they were just being rude, or perhaps were yelling at them because they thought that, and I'm not sure what they thought. So shopping in general can actually be quite annoying and at times even more othering and isolating, and you end up going home and shopping online, and then for people that shop online there are even more accessibility barriers at the time. So there's those kinds of stories. There's also those general misconceptions of when I work with a brand, I usually have to prep them that when I am included in photos or videos with my cane, people will make comment or approach them and ask them if they're selling canes now. Or will often say, why is this person included if you're not selling canes? And I need to prepare them for their responses for that. There have been comments made like including people with disability in media and advertising detracts from the product that people are trying to sell. So there's a lot of things in the mix.
Lots for the retail industry to learn, because every customer is everyone's a shopper, right? So in fact the retail industry doing it quite tough at the moment, and there's just markets that are just not being currently explored appropriately. And this is part of this series, is to bring attention to people with difference, I guess. That's probably the main theme.
I've actually forgotten the number. My mum brain is failing me right now, but it's more than 53% of our global population are either connected to by family or friendship, or are a person with disability.
Yeah.
And if you're not marketing to that population, or you're, because we're, people who understand disability or the disability ecosystem are very loyal to their values.
Yes.
And if you're not marketing for or to those people, then you're missing out on a huge population of people.
Well, that's the thing. It's not only the right thing to do, it also makes good economic sense. Now, Angel, that's been a really good conversation. I've got to say, you've got a really calming voice.
Oh, my son is actually asleep now, so I'm trying to keep.
I've had a very busy day. This has been a really relaxing conversation, so I appreciate that.
I hope that doesn't mean I'm putting you to sleep.
No, not at all. He's just put me in a very calm state, so I appreciate that. So, Angel, maybe in summary, maybe for the listeners listening today, could you just give us your practical tips for retailers understand people living with a disability when shopping in store and online?
So my practical tips would be, my husband is in tech, so I know a bit about online accessibility, and I guess my lived experience tells me that we need to ensure that there is not only room for wheelchairs to navigate a store, but there is thoughtful consideration put into the way things are displayed, a fit out as far as counters and pay stations and all of those kinds of things. Co-design really needs to be considered when, particularly in larger department stores, because obviously that's one of the biggest places that we can really make a significant difference. Mm-hmm. So co-design, making sure people with disability are included in the process of designing, could really help that change. As far as online goes, it really is misunderstood that websites are simply always accessible. For people who use a screen reader to access things online, there are so many barriers and so many things that can make that experience really challenging. There's a thing that we call the WCAG compliance, which is the accessibility compliance. There's a course. I actually have a little segment that that they've chopped out of one of my talks and popped it in the WCAG course. And you can go online and learn more about that. And you really need to make sure that your website is WCAG compliant, or that you're going through a developer who understands those design components. My husband, being in tech, everything he talks about that the web is inherently accessible, and designers do things that break it. And so that's why it's so important to have a designer that knows what they're doing, have a developer that knows and understands what accessibility is and why it's needed. Unfortunately, I am told a lot of the time that accessibility is the death of good website design, and that's just simply not true. It just means the person isn't knowledgeable enough or hasn't worked hard enough. that would be my biggest tip. Just make sure you comply with the latest WCAG components, and make sure you have someone who knows what they're doing, and I guess values inclusion.
Well, on that note, Angel, thank you so much for sharing those tips and sharing your journey with us. Appreciate you giving us your time today on Retail Therapy, and I wish you all the very best for the future.
Thanks so much, Paul. Thanks for having me.
I would now like to welcome Mitchell Kurius, Chief Financial Officer at Barbecues Galore, to the Amex Lounge. Barbecues Galore has been supplying Australians with high-quality barbecues and expert advice since 1977. With more than 90 stores throughout the country, Barbecues Galore leads the barbecue retailing market and is a specialist in outdoor furniture and heating. Barbecues Galore has been an American Express merchant for more than two decades. Mitch, welcome.
Hi, Paul. Great to be here with you.
Barbecues Galore is an iconic Australian brand that started as a small business more than 45 years ago. Mitch, can you describe the recent journey of the brand, its challenges, and the transformation over the past 5 years?
The recent journey of Barbecues Galore over the last 5 years has really been to stay true to the heritage of the brand whilst developing our platforms around brand, team, and technology to support the changing dynamics of the consumer through this period. We've seen through the last 5 years some significant macro disruptions, from bushfires of 2019 to COVID to supply disruptions. And through that period, the organisation is really galvanised and in really strong position looking forward.
Now, Mitch, it's a tricky time for retailers at the moment as cost of living pressures start to take their toll. How is Barbecues Galore adapting to this, and what does the future hold?
A core focus for the organisation is to really focus on demonstrating value through the assortment at every touch point of the assortment. And the team have done a tremendous job through the little while to ensure that we have new, innovative and sometimes exclusive product to really surprise and delight our customers. We also recognise that cost of living pressures are not just on the shoulders of customers, but also on our team. And we've done a really, put in a lot of work in around ensuring that Barbecues Galore is an employer of choice and supporting our team with those cost of living pressures.
Now, Barbecues Galore purpose is bringing people together around the flame. Those great connections formed around food and fire. Now, how do you go about developing those connections for your customers and your colleagues, and why is this important?
Humans have been sharing treasured moments around a flame for millennia, Paul, and that gives us some really rich material to work with, tooling the team up with their career pathways and help them with that whole sales process. Helps us to deliver on the purpose to customers as well.
Mitch, thank you for joining us today in the Amex Lounge. All the best for the future.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for joining us in the Amex Lounge for some retail therapy. Make sure you subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify. We can be found wherever you listen to your favourite podcasts. For more information about the work we do at the Australian Retailers Association, head to our website, retail.org.au. Follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, wherever you love to connect. All the links can be found in the show notes.